Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
Ukraine counterattacks Russian troops around the war-ravaged city of Kharkiv. Plus, the war drives a new trend in global trade, friend-shoring.
The idea is to reduce reliance on countries like China and Russia, who have different values and also have different economic systems.
And JetBlue plots a hostile takeover of Spirit Airlines. It's Monday, May 16th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. The governor of Ukraine's northeasternmost region has said Ukrainian forces had reached the country's border with Russia, signaling progress as Ukraine fights to win back territory seized by Russian forces in recent months. Russia has inflicted on Kharkiv, Ukraine's second-largest city, some of the worst devastation seen in Europe since World War II. As attacks continued elsewhere in the country, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky vowed to bring the feverish activity by Russian forces to an end. Russia's war in Ukraine has also pushed Finland a step closer toward the NATO alliance. On Sunday, Finnish President Sauli Niinistö said the government would apply for membership subject to approval by parliament, which is widely expected in the coming days. Finland has for decades been a major holdout among Western nations outside NATO. Sweden, another longtime holdout, is also expected to apply for membership soon. NATO leaders said on Sunday they were confident that objections expressed by Turkey against the Swedish and Finnish bids could be overcome, allowing both countries to swiftly join the alliance. The 18-year-old suspected of killing 10 people at a Buffalo, New York supermarket on Saturday had been brought to a hospital by state police last June for a mental health evaluation after expressing a desire to carry out a mass shooting, officials said. Peyton Gendron pleaded not guilty after being arraigned on murder charges. An attorney representing Gendron didn't immediately return a call seeking comment. The White House has announced that President Joe Biden will travel to Buffalo on Tuesday. In a separate shooting, one person was killed and four others wounded on Sunday in a Southern California church. The Orange County Sheriff's Office said one suspect was in custody and two handguns were recovered at the scene. China has reported a sharp cooling of economic activity in April, with official data showing the effects of stringent COVID-19 control measures that have locked down cities and disrupted businesses. WSJ Asia Markets editor Quinton Webb has more.
We have seen a big fall in year-over-year retail sales. Industrial production has also taken a hit. These numbers are worse, actually, than most economists were expecting. And fixed asset investment has slowed. So you can see the rather obvious effects of making it very difficult for people to move around, to go to the shops, or to even in some cases go to their offices and factories.
And JetBlue Airways says it plans to launch a hostile takeover attempt for Spirit Airlines after its $3.6 billion offer was rejected in favor of Spirit's existing deal with Frontier Airlines. JetBlue intends to offer Spirit's investors $30 a share in hopes of pressuring the company's management to re-engage in negotiations. Representatives for Spirit and Frontier didn't immediately respond to requests for comment outside regular business hours. The global carbon credit market allows countries with valuable carbon-capturing natural resources like rainforests to profit off of their preservation through the sale of carbon credits. Those credits are then bought by businesses and others looking to reduce their overall carbon footprint. But as WSJ Southeast Asia reporter John Emont explains, two major suppliers of carbon credits, Indonesia and Papua New Guinea, are rethinking their participation in the market, given that UN rules prohibit countries who sell credits from counting them towards their own carbon reduction targets. And John joins us now with a look at what this move could tell us about the state of carbon markets. John, thanks for being with us. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
John, what could the effect be for the global carbon trading market if Indonesia and Papua New Guinea decide eventually to pull back from that market?
Right. Well, as more companies pile in and try to buy these voluntary credits, there's more demand for these credits. So any restrictions on supply could be problematic for companies that are hoping to use carbon credits to reduce their overall emissions. Indonesia is the biggest supplier of forestry and land management related carbon credits over the last decade plus, according to Verra, which is one of the two major registries tracking the sector. So in other words, Indonesia is kind of a big deal in this space. And Papua New Guinea is also very heavily forested, so also has the capacity to generate a lot of credits. So in that sense, if these two countries hold back, that could have a significant implication for companies that were hoping to use these credits to reduce their carbon emissions. But of course, we just don't know exactly how long-term these actions will be and under what circumstances Indonesia and PNG might decide to resume full engagement with these voluntary markets.
And John, it seems like potentially not great news for the planet either. Is that wrong?
I mean, that's certainly how some in the industry would see it, but there are also a lot of critics of these projects, you know, who argue that they don't really do too much to prevent global warming. For example, they argue that just because some developer buys up some stretch of rainforest, that doesn't necessarily decrease net deforestation in these countries, because anyone who wants to destroy the rainforest to set up a plantation or something can just carve around these sort of pockets that have been created. So effectively, they might not do so much good for the planet is one argument. And the other thing, of course, is that big Western companies are using these carbon credits to get to net zero. But some would argue, wait, you shouldn't use carbon credits to get to net zero. You should develop technologies and methods to get to net zero yourself. So essentially, this whole system is actually just continuing the same processes that created climate change in the first place and isn't necessarily protecting it. So your attitude about this will really depend on whether you think that these carbon markets are actually helpful at resolving global warming or not.
That was WSJ Southeast Asia reporter John Emont joining us today from Singapore. John, thank you for the update.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the U.S. and its allies are turning to friend shoring to protect supply chains. We'll learn what that is and how it works after the break.
You're a growing business and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
The war in Ukraine and the pandemic have exposed the fragility of supply chains, and now the U.S. and its allies are pursuing a new kind of global trade that confines commerce to a circle of trusted nations. Fans call the shift friendshoring, and companies including Samsung and Gap are tapping into the trend. WSJ Trade and International Economy reporter Yuka Hayashi joins us now with more on this. Hi, Yuka.
Hi, Luke.
So why are countries making this shift toward friendshoring, as you describe it?
So friendshoring, it's an effort to try to work with allies and friendly countries to increase production of critical products and then expand trade with each other. The idea is to reduce reliance on countries like China and Russia, who have different values and also have different economic systems. So I've heard people describe friendshoring in different ways. Some say, well, it's a sort of compromise between complete globalization and complete isolationism, or offshoring and onshoring, which is domestic production. If you bring everything back home, it makes supply chains really secure, but then it creates other problems like, you know, sharp increases in costs that could even make the inflation worse. And some materials just may not be available.
So which countries exactly are setting about trying to build these new supply chains?
So this is still in an early stage, but there are some discussions that are starting. One example that I looked at is this discussion between the U.S. government and Australia to try to jointly help the expansion of capacities for rare earth minerals. What they're doing is to get mining companies in Australia to meet with U.S. manufacturers and discuss plans to build mining and processing facilities both in Australia and in the U.S. Jointly. The governments are also looking into using government financing to fund some of these projects.
I mean, is it really possible to scale this up to friendshore and not route global supply lines through a country, for example, like China?
That is a good question. Right now, the effort is more about diversifying supplies rather than pulling entirely out of China, which is very, very difficult, if not impossible, because we rely on China for so many things. For example, if you look at clothing, 80% of clothes that we wear are made in China. In the case of some critical minerals, we rely on China pretty much entirely. So pulling out of China is just really difficult. But, you know, they are trying to reduce the reliance and trying to build new supply sources.
I mean, all of this sounds like a return in some ways to the way trade was sort of conducted prior to the wave of globalization seen in the 1990s. Is there anything different now?
So, yes, in a way, it's sort of a return to the state before the 1990s. The main point of friendshoring is to reduce reliance on China. And the Chinese exports really started taking off after 2001, which is the year when China joined the World Trade Organization and started reaping the benefits of free trade rules. So in a way, it's trying to go partially back to the era before that.
And should we expect to see this friend-shoring kind of trade policy expand beyond the likes of the U.S. and Australia?
So there's a lot of discussions going on between the U.S. and Europe about cooperating on strengthening supply chains for products like semiconductors, 5G wireless technology. In the case of rare earth, there's an idea to work together not just with Australia, but with Japan and India. So a lot of countries are involved. And if you look at businesses, they are a step ahead of the governments. And there have been a lot of shift of production from China to countries like Mexico, countries in Central America, and that involved companies like clothing makers, automakers. And their shift was actually prompted by the trade war with China over the past several years. So that's an example of nearshoring, which also can be described as friendshoring. So it's just happening all over the world.
That was Wall Street Journal trade and international economy reporter Yuka Hayashi. Yuka, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And finally, as countries prioritize their friends in the domain of global trade, the trend in management right now is to rally teams with empathy, as in taking a genuine interest in the lives of our coworkers. So if you've been wondering, why is my boss asking about my feelings lately? WSJ features reporter Ray Smith, who works on our careers team, says it could be because being more empathetic is good for business.
There are studies that show that besides talent recruitment and retention, that productivity and things like absenteeism and just a matter of employee morale, even though it's not a direct line, it does add to the bottom line because you're getting employees potentially who are more engaged and feel like they would work harder for a company that seems to care for them.
And that's What's News for Monday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack.
Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.